Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Fingers Crossed.
We'll hear stories of superstition, mischief, and hoping for the best.
Our first storyteller, Gretchen Day, seems to have always been one to jump in with her fingers crossed. She moved to Bethel in 1990, sight unseen, for a one-year job. But this story takes place even before she made her way to Alaska.
My story took place in 1986 in Botswana. And Botswana at that time was a trackless land teeming with herds of springbok and zebras, prides of lions, cheetahs, you name it. People lived in small villages in brown mud huts with thatched roofs and no electricity or running water. I was there with the Peace Corps to teach high school science. I just graduated from college in North Carolina, where I'd lived all my life up till that point. North Carolina is tame. There's virtually nothing dangerous in that state. If anything is the slightest bit dangerous, you're not allowed to do it. It's a stark contrast to Africa. We'd just finished 3 months of training, learning Setswana, the local language, and the culture, when Peace Corps held a picnic for the 200 volunteers, new and old, in the country. They bussed us all out to a picnic area on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, and they provided us with kegs of beer and grilled goat, bubbling cauldrons of sampan beans and cornmeal porridge. I was sitting at a picnic table with my best friend, Teresa, when she motioned to a sign that read, "Lion Enclosure." And she said, you want to take some pictures? We wandered down a dirt trail for about a quarter mile till we came to a high chain link fence, about 12 feet. The fence enclosed several acres of thorn bushes and rocks and stands of grass and at least half a dozen lions. One of the lions was pacing along the fence. I stuck my fingers through the chain link. I wanted to pet him when he came by. But then I reconsidered. Teresa was behind me, focusing her 35mm camera. That was before digital. She kept angling the lens one way and another. Finally, she grabbed the chain link and shook it, and she said, "I can't take a shot through this fence. I want to go inside. Do you think the lions are tame?" Well, I considered it. I said, "I think they get fed, so they're probably not hungry. And lions don't typically eat people, so they wouldn't have a taste for humans already. Matter of fact, I've known so many humans that wouldn't eat anything they'd never tasted before. I doubt it would happen. There's no cubs. I don't see why they would attack us. We should ask the gamekeeper. He wouldn't let us in if it was dangerous." So back at the picnic, I spotted the gamekeeper. He was this old Botswana man in a khaki uniform with epaulettes on his shoulders. He was talking to the cook, a Botswana woman, grilling the goat. I approached him. "Dumela ra otsahile." That's the correct address. He responded, "Dumela ma." Now, I knew it was impolite in Setswana to get to the point of conversation right away. But I was impatient, so I said, "Can we go in the lion enclosure?" He stared at me. Then he said something to the cook in Setswana, and they both started laughing. I thought, maybe he didn't understand. So I took Teresa's camera, and I said, "Ditao, the lions, we want to take photos." He stopped laughing. Now he was angry. He started yelling in Setswana, waving his wooden staff in the air. I whispered to Teresa,
I guess the lions aren't tame.
As he finished his rant, I was about to walk away when suddenly he said, "Come." And he strode off through the crowd. Teresa and I rushed after him. He started down the path to the lions. I said, "Maybe there's a viewing platform. We didn't really look for one." When we got to the fence, he pulled a ring of keys from his belt, opened the gate, ushered us in. He went in and closed the gate. I was shocked. I had never expected to get in. The lion who'd been stalking along the fence was at the far corner. Ahead of us, two lions lay next to a rock. On the ground, they looked less intimidating. Teresa snapped a couple of shots. Farther on, we saw a large male with a full mane. He was sitting upright next to a stand of grass. Teresa said, "Go pose with the lion, Gretchen." I was scared. Those animals were powerful, at least 400 pounds with 2-inch claws. But still, when was I ever going to get another chance to pose with a lion? I stood next to him. Teresa said, "Put your hand on his head." I wasn't sure what to do with my hand, but I've had cats, so I started scratching behind his ears. He didn't seem to mind. I said, "Teresa, hurry and take the picture." Teresa said, "I'm having trouble focusing. It's frightening to put the camera to my face with the lions behind me." "Really?" I continued to scratch. Suddenly, the lion twisted his head, took my arm in his mouth. He wasn't biting, but I couldn't get my arm free. I said, "Teresa, he's got my arm in his mouth." Teresa said, "Well, pull it out." I tugged gently, but you guys know what cats do when you pull something away from them. He bit down harder. I panicked. I ripped my arm out of his mouth. His tooth sliced the skin. There was a drip of blood. I turned and ran. He lunged forward with his teeth and grabbed the back of my shorts and jerked me to a halt. And suddenly, the seams on my shorts gave, and I stumbled forward. Teresa grabbed me, and we ran. The other lions had gotten excited by all the commotion. The air was full of roars and rumbles and dust from the ground as they pounded towards us. The gamekeeper ran forward with his staff, knocking the lions out of the way to make a path. We all three got out the gate, and I had no pants. But I had brought a skirt in my backpack because I really shouldn't have been wearing shorts. It was improper. So I ran to the bus, put on my dress, and then I thought, you know, that was really dangerous. I wonder why the gamekeeper let us in. It occurred to me that Botswana had been a colony until just recently. This man had had to obey white people most of his life. I had put him in a really difficult position, having to decide whether to refuse my request or allow me to be in danger. I thought, yeah, that's why he did it. But over the years, as I've thought about it, I've wondered, did that old man maybe think that that foolish white girl needed to get her butt bitten? Thank you.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, where we hear true stories told by Alaskans. We just heard from Anchorage resident Gretchen Day.
Next up, we hear from Rebecca Arnold, who was born and raised in Kotzebue. Here she is on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
I didn't know what I was looking for until I'd found it. It was my second summer working at the Red Dog Mine, and this summer, I was working as an environmental technician. I would be taking dust and water samples all around the mine site via helicopter. It was going to be a pretty sweet job. Although, I was a little nervous because I had only worked in an office and hadn't worked outside before. So walking into the office, I see this guy sitting on a stool, and his jaw literally dropped. I mean, I think I look pretty good, but at Red Dog, I think I'm a 12. So we had this really weird first interaction, and I find out this guy is going to be the helicopter pilot that's going to help me do my job all summer. But I wasn't very worried because I was already dating an airline pilot. And I would tell him all the time how amazing this airline pilot was. One day, I got a package in the mail. It was this box from the airline pilot. So I go downstairs to the dining hall. I find out where he's sitting. I sit right next to him, and I open up this package and throw the contents on the table. Socks. White, long socks. The helicopter pilot looks at me, and he says, "But where's your card?" Stunned that this guy knew what I was hoping for in the box, I grab all of my things, and I leave the dining hall. So that was the end of the airline pilot, my relationship, and the beginning of the helicopter pilot, my relationship. Although it was the beginning of our relationship, the summer was coming to an end, which means the job was going to be over soon. I was headed to Colorado to finish up school, and he had a winter break. So he came down and spent the winter with me. And then he had to go back up to Alaska to finish work. He found a place for Palmer for us, and I thought, great, after I graduate college, I have a place to go. So I graduated college and did what any smart college student would do. I sold my vehicle and purchased an airline ticket straight to Alaska. So I get to Palmer. I didn't think this through. I had no vehicle, no job. And by the time I got there, the helicopter pilot was already out in the field working. So that summer was pretty rough. And he ended up cheating on me at the end of the summer. So I was in this place that I had never been before. I was completely dependent. And he was like, "Well, you know, I still love you. Do you want to be with me?" I had nothing to lose. So I stuck it out with the helicopter pilot. So that fall, my sister was having her birthday bash, and she had just moved from Anchorage to Eagle River. And things were pretty rough, so I needed a break. So she texted me her new address, and I drove right over to the address, parked my car, and I walked right through the door. Ping. There was a guy sitting in a recliner playing a guitar. Is this where my sister lives? Sure enough, I had found the right house and she was getting ready. So the guy in the chair, he owns the house. He's an architect. And he has a topographical map and loves hiking and camping like I do. So we just start really talking. So he shows me this really cool map, and I ask him where he got it from. So he writes on a post-it note where he found it, and my sister's ready for the night. So I leave with her and don't see him again. So things were getting pretty rough still with the helicopter pilot. And he was like, "Well, we should go to Hawaii in January." So it sounds like a great idea to me, but things are still pretty rough. My sister moved from Eagle River back over to Anchorage, and it was pirate pub night. She was like, "Do you want to go to the pirate pub crawl with me?" I was like, "Yars!" So we go out with all the other pirates and wenches, and guess who we see? So the guy in the chair, his name is Jason. So we see Jason walking by. "Hey, how's it going?" And sure enough, he keeps walking. He says, "Well, hey guys, it's good to see you. I've got to go." So there he went. So I don't know how I made it to January, but it was time to go to Hawaii. So me and the helicopter pilot go to Hawaii, and the plan was to spend 1 week in Maui and he was going to go and spend the next week on the Big Island. The week in paradise just flew by. I was home before I knew it, and he would call me and tell me how things were going. So one of the first phone calls I got, he's like, "Man, my parents are super bummed that we broke up." And that's how I found out we were over. So I packed up all of my things and was out of the place before he got home. So I had moved in with my sister, and I was super bummed out about this relationship that had completely failed no matter how hard I had tried and needed a distraction. Luckily, it was First Friday, and we had a mutual friend who would go with me downtown. So I go with our friend, and the first place that we go to, I see Jason sitting. I say, "Hey man, how's it going?" So he introduces me to his coworker. I introduce him to my mutual friend, and sure enough, they know each other, and they already have each other's phone numbers. So we all decide that we'd meet up later at the museum. So he never did show up at the museum. So I decided to forget all about boys and relationships and focus all on work. So for work, I was recruiting, and they had an event at the Denina Center where I got to work a booth. So I'm at the Denina Center, working the booth, and I see a bunch of different people go by. Work was going great. And I look up, and I see Jason walk in. And I see him grab his phone and start texting. So I walk right in front of him, and I say, "You can put your phone down. I'm right here." So right then, I had found myself and my husband.
That was Rebecca Arnold, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. We'll break now from some stories to hear a little music. Each month, our Arctic Entries live show features a local musician.
Emily Kern-Tallman spent over a decade as a nationally touring songwriter and has now lived in Anchorage for 14 years. Here she is with her original tune, "I'm Just Like You."
We all started in the water and we swam into the room, where the lamps were all much brighter than the lighting in the womb. And the air was cold inside our lungs. We found some comfort in our thumb, so we stuck it in our mouth. And we wished we could go back to that place that only we knew, but we couldn't find the door. Still the voice was so familiar, so we let her calm us down, and we wrapped our tiny hand around her finger. I'm just like you, you're just like me. Sometimes that's almost impossible to see. Our blood both runs blue through our hands. Just like you, you're just like me. In the kitchens of Fallujah, on the shores of Vietnam, in the trees of California, in the vines of the Amazon, where the reindeer walk in Norway, where the rhesus monkeys play, we all gather by the fire, pushing through another day. I'm just like you, you're just like me. Sometimes that's almost impossible to see. Our blood both runs blue through our hands and our feet. I'm just like you, you're just like me. Mm-hmm. even Plato didn't like to be alone. Even Joan of Arc wished she could go home. Maybe William Shakespeare felt misunderstood. Maybe Jesus wished he'd stuck to working wood. I'm just like you, you're just like me. Sometimes that's almost impossible to see. Our blood both runs blue through our hands and our feet. I'm just like you, you're just like me.
That was Emily Kern Tallman, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is Fingers Crossed, stories of superstition, mischief, and hoping for the best.
Our next storyteller, Jeff Campbell, recently retired after spending 25 years in the Alaska Air National Guard. Through his service, he's come to some really important conclusions about hope, as life has handed him some trying circumstances.
So I was born in Springfield, Missouri. I went to college and ROTC at the University of Kansas. I joined the Air Force to see the world, and they sent me to Oklahoma. Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City, to be exact. Now, I did get to see the world, but that came later, and that's a different set of stories. Now, on this particular day, I was 26 years old, I was a first lieutenant, I was a flight commander, and I was assigned to the 32nd Combat Communications Squadron, 3rd Combat Communications Group, better known by its nickname of the Third Herd. We were a deployable communications squadron of about 150 people. I was responsible for about 50 of them. So this particular day started out like most any other. We started with our flight meeting first thing, and we had went through the training stories of the week and the mission and things that needed to get done and so on. But the meeting ended a little non-standard. We had a cake and a little recognition ceremony for one of our young airmen, Airman First Class Courtney McCraven. She had just been named the squadron's Airman of the Year out of about 150 people, and she had also just gotten married the weekend before to another member of the squadron. So we had a nice little cake and a ceremony to tell her congratulations for both getting married and winning this honor in the award, or winning this honor in the squadron. Now, she was just one of those troops that, as a leader, you looked at and went, if you give me a squadron of her, I can be unstoppable. She was a wonderful troop, hard worker. Obviously, she had just won a major, a nice award. And like me, she was from the Midwest. She was from South Dakota. And she had also joined the Air Force to see the world. So we finished up and wrapped up, and we said our congrats again, and she headed off. She was going down to the Social Security office to get her name legally changed because she had just gotten married that weekend. So sometime later, I was sitting in the squadron staff meeting with the squadron commander and everybody, and the commander's secretary burst in and said that there were news reports that a bomb had just gone off downtown. This day might have started off like any other, but the date was April 19th, 1995, and an Army veteran named Timothy McVeigh had decided to make a statement. And he made a statement with what we call in today's parlance a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device that he had stationed outside the Alfred Murrah Building in downtown Oklahoma City, and he detonated it. So we were all initially in shock, weren't sure what to do. We kind of milled about a little bit and tried to figure out how we could help, what could we do. And then a short time later, I got the news that no military leader ever wants to hear. One of my troops was unaccounted for. One of the people I was responsible for was missing, and it was Courtney. So again, after a little bit more milling about, and if I'm being honest, a little bit of conjecture and rumor mill among us going, was this a Middle Eastern terrorist attack? What's going on? Keep in mind, this is pre-9/11. This is before Khobar Towers, but you still kind of go there. There were enough terrorist incidents around the world to wonder if this might be what we were facing. So after some coordination with the state and the local officials, we started loading up. We were a mobile deployable communication squadron, but we also had stuff that could be useful. We had cots, generators, tents, camping gear on steroids, we called it. So we started loading up and we headed down, and pulling up on the scene is it's tough to come up with the words today. Surreal just doesn't quite cut it. It was this hulking ruin. You've seen pictures and video for the most part. Two-thirds of the building just caved in on itself. It was not a good scene to show up. But we got there and we got to work. We had good people. We were trained. And now our folks were motivated because one of our own was in that building. So that was the start of what I call my longest day. It's actually several 24-hour periods, but the time span is one contiguous period in my mind. The memories are all jumbled together. And I can remember some very powerful experiences throughout that time frame. For one thing, when you were down at the site and working, you were never hungry, because when Oklahoma grandmothers don't know what else to do, they start cooking. To say nothing of all the restaurants and other folks that donated food. I remember another shift. One of the coordinators, one of the incident commanders, came to us and said, "We need military members. We need military people." Of course. "What do you need? Where do you need us?" So we went over to the zone that they needed us, and I ended up being part of an ad hoc honor guard to repatriate the remains of the Marine Corps captain who was in charge of the recruiting office that was also in the building. Now, to be fair, during this time, we're still holding out hope that Cartney could be found. It's obviously a powerful experience. But eventually, of course, over time, the folks get, everyone gets identified and accounted for except for those who are in the building. There was another time during the period that one of the coordinators came and said, "We need people to help with the rescue dogs." So we go, and sure, what do you need? So we go there, and several of us ended up going inside the building and covering ourselves with rubble and pretending to be victims, because the rescue dogs were becoming so despondent at not finding people, they were refusing to go in the building and work. So that's another powerful experience. Now, throughout this time, I learned some very powerful lessons. Number one, I learned as a leader, be careful, choose your words carefully, because you can't take them back. I still cringe at some of the things that I told Cartney's husband, Shane, in the early hours, just being optimistic that we're going to find her and surely she's going to come through. It's going to be okay. And I was just faking optimism with nothing to back it up. So you got to be careful in those moments. To be fair, we did hold out hope for several days, but eventually everyone was accounted for, and sadly her body was actually found several weeks later in the recovery. I also learned that you shouldn't jump to conclusions. You know, like I said, we initially thought I might be a Middle Eastern terrorist, but to find out later that it was a former colleague in the profession of arms who decided to make such a statement would be infuriating and insulting as a member of that profession of arms. So again, don't jump to conclusions. So overall, I learned a lot of individual lessons, but I think the bigger lesson for all of us is let's all work towards a society where people like McVeigh don't need to make statements like that so people like Cartney get their chance to see the world. Thank you.
Thanks to Jeff Campbell for that story. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
If you hear a story you'd like to share with a friend, all of the past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website, arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also listen to this show in its entirety at alaskapublic.org.
Now we're going to hear from Nicole Stellan O'Donnell, who knows a little about the power of smiles and mischief, even in the most challenging of situations.
3 years ago, 2 days after Christmas, my husband TJ and I had to rush our 8-year-old daughter to the emergency room. Her 10-year-old sister had run into the kitchen saying, "Mom, there's something really, really wrong." And we went to the couch and found our youngest curled in a ball, quiet, turning kind of gray and moaning. And when we pressed on her stomach, she screamed. We thought it was appendicitis. When we got to the hospital, We learned she had a tumor the size of a loaf of bread in her abdomen. It was Wilms' tumor, a kind of pediatric kidney cancer that had consumed her entire kidney and then grown, pushing everything else out of the way. It ruptured. That's why she was in pain. That night, TJ and I went from being normal parents to being cancer parents. And in our first act as cancer parents, we had to sit through a six-hour surgery while they removed the tumor, its remnants, and her kidney. That day, we just sat there on those uncomfortable chairs and we cried, and maybe we held hands a little now and then, but we didn't really have any resources to deal with it. We didn't know anything. A week later, we knew a lot of things. We knew about chemo, we knew about radiation, we knew about treatment roadmaps, and we had just learned that our daughter's cancer was staged at stage 3. That was good news, but it was temporary good news. Because when they scanned her, they also found a tiny little spot on her lung. They couldn't do anything about that yet because they were still dealing with the loaf of bread. So what they did is they said she's going to have chemo, radiation for 6 weeks, and we'll do another set of scans. We're going to restage her. If at 6 weeks that little spot has responded to treatment and it's gone, she will stay stage 3. If it's still there, she'll be stage 4. That day, the oncologist gave me a piece of advice. He said, look, just really don't go home and Google any of this. And so I did exactly what any panicked parent would do. I Googled it all. I Googled Wilms tumor stage 3, Wilms tumor stage 4, pediatric Wilms tumor survival rates, pediatric siblings cancer, pediatric cancer effect on siblings. I Googled all of it. You see, as a cancer parent, you have a lot of time to Google. Because for my daughter to get treatment, she and I had to live here in Anchorage, 359 miles away from her dad, TJ, who had to keep his job to keep his health insurance, and her sister, who had to go to school. But I got busy. My job, because I couldn't do my job anymore, my job became taking her to appointments. And there were lots. There was radiation, there was chemo infusion, there was pediatric nephrology, pediatric cardiology, the dietitian, and that awful appointment at the fancy, fancy spa where we took her to get her pixie cut to help her deal with her rapidly disappearing hair. You see, being a cancer parent is just a little bit like being the cruise director in hell. And to get through those 6 weeks of uncertainty, you know what I had to do? I was going to be the best cruise director hell had ever seen. So to that end, it kept me busy and it kept me not thinking about her lung. And not thinking about the spot on her lung, but those 6 weeks went by with me thinking or not thinking. And one day the oncologist, after my daughter had had another set of scans, looked at me when she entered the infusion room and did this, a little tip of the head over towards the conference room, and I knew it wasn't good news. The spot on her lung was still there. It hadn't changed at all. And what our oncologist told me when I asked what the odds were, she said this. She said, okay, so we're gonna assume the spot on her lung is Wilms' tumor, and then we're gonna be pleasantly surprised if it's not. And she told me that it was time for my daughter to have another surgery, this time a surgical lung biopsy. So TJ came down from Fairbanks. We readied ourselves for another round of waiting in the surgical waiting room. But you know, this time we weren't newbies. Like, we had this down, right? We were professionals. We had 6 weeks under our belt. We knew about this cancer stuff. So instead of crying and holding hands, we sat there to distract ourselves, spinning joke after joke about how our daughter's pediatric surgeon was actually the Hulk. Now, before you think we're callous or maybe not taking her cancer seriously enough, I do have to tell you this. Dr. Hulk, which is what I'm going to call him for the rest of this piece, Dr. Hulk clearly is very devoted to his exercise regimen. Like, even his fingers were very muscular. And on top of that, Dr. Hulk is very, very ruggedly handsome. So now, don't judge me. Even TJ said, like, I don't want to be weird about it, but like, you're right, he's really good looking for a guy. So, you know, it was easy to make the Hulk jokes. You know, like, we really hope Dr. Hulk doesn't get angry in surgery. And, you know, we wondered if he would come out to give us the news in his ripped surgical scrubs with his chest rippling. And, you know, of course, the classic Hulk smash cancer. Yeah, we were handling it really well, right? Like, we were totally calm. We were making these jokes. Nothing had us panicked at all. So we made it through surgery. But I want to tell you this. You know, when your kid has a biopsy, there's surgery. And then there's also waiting for pathology results. Now, we had to wait 4 days from the lung biopsy to knowing whether that spot on her lung was Wilms' tumor. 4 days. If it had been me with cancer, if it had been TJ with cancer, we'd have had a whole host of coping mechanisms. For example, getting drunk, punching a hole in the wall, eating pint after pint of ice cream, maybe swearing. But we were in a tiny hospital guest house room with an 8-year-old who was groggy and angry and uncomfortable and could do nothing but watch episode after episode of Shaun the Sheep on Netflix. And while she did this, we were supposed to be getting her to do her complicated breathing exercises to help her lungs clear. It was a really bad 4 days. And so we kept joking about the Hulk. Yes, we did, but I went to an even darker place. And I'll admit it. I started Googling again, but I knew better than to Google my kid's cancer. Like, I had learned that lesson. So, you know, I just started Googling Dr. Hulk himself. And okay, like that's, you know, some of you might call that a coping mechanism, and there's a fine line between that and internet stalking. I've got that. But see, Dr. Hulk was really, really attractive. And I had a newly divorced friend who probably would have really appreciated an introduction to a hot pediatric surgeon. So that's where I put my energy. I wanted to know if he had kids, if he was divorced, if he was married, of course, maybe what some of his hobbies were. I found lots of pictures of him. It got so bad that at one point I actually said to TJ, okay, I have an idea. Let's invite said divorced friend to the surgical follow-up appointment for the cancer kid so we can introduce her to Dr. Hulk. And you know, my husband, he was on the same page. He said, sure. So that's where we were at. You know, we thought we were really holding it together. But it really took our kid to point out that we weren't. Because at one point, the divorced friend was over visiting us, and I opened up Facebook, and I brought up Dr. Hulk's profile picture, and I pointed out his dreamy blue eyes. And at that point, my daughter said, Mom, show my surgeon some respect. He is a nice man, and he is not even green. So, we got through the 4 days, I think pretty well. And, you know, eventually the kid wanted to shut off Shaun the Sheep. Eventually we could leave the hospital guest house again. And you know what? Eventually she finally said, kind of like acknowledging our sense of humor, she said, yeah, you're right, I'm glad he didn't get mad in surgery, ha ha. But I'll tell you this, the only reason she was able to come to appreciate our sense of humor was because we were finally able to stop making those jokes. Because you see, the oncologist had called. And she had the results of the biopsy. And against all odds, that cancer kid, it was negative. She got to stay stage 3.
That was Nicole Stellan O'Donnell of Fairbanks. You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. As you may know, we're hearing Alaskans tell true stories about their lives.
Gregory Nothstein is a lifelong Alaskan from Nome who is now a champion for sobriety. Here he is on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts to tell us about how he got there.
So back in 1987, I was having a time of my life. And then I had this deja vu, call it a divine, wondrous intervention in Homer, Alaska. And I ended up coming to in a jail cell. Divine, wondrous intervention, figure it out. DWI. I went through the process of alcohol screening. I went through all that process, and I had 8 months to figure it out. And I remember having to go to this inpatient alcohol treatment center, and I went through the whole rigmarole, and I'll tell you what, at the end of 27 days of a 28-day treatment program, they said, your culture will never keep you sober. Maybe you got to go back out and work on a better story, because this ain't a bed of breakfast. Anyway, that was like, no, I want to stay here. I want to stay here. I know I can help myself. You got something for me. And, well, here I was, freshly kicked out of this treatment center. Spirit Days board member come up to me and said, hey, listen, Greg, we know that you put some rope handles and helped Paul Tiolanda, the late King Island dancer leader, make a blanket before. So we need some rope handles on this walrus skin blanket for Spirit Days, this annual event. Do you think you could do that? And I said, sure, I got nothing better to do. So they brought me to a warehouse. They showed me this 8-foot-long walrus skin. And nobody's seen a walrus skin rolled up and dried out like an old pair of wet cowboy boots. You know how stiff those can get. And here we go. I tried to unroll this thing, and it wouldn't unroll. It just recoiled right back up like one of those rolled maps in school that didn't want to stay down. So I found 4 boxes of nails in this warehouse. They were 40 pounds each, and I weighed that thing down. I forced it open, and I said, man, the first thing I got to do is I got to scrape the mold and mildew off. I found this putty knife. I started scraping it what I could off. It wasn't working, so I found something else. I found this little wire brush that you use for scraping those files. And I had to get on my hands and knees. I got on my hands and knees, and the oil started to go through my pants. I found some coveralls. Boy, this thing smelled ripe like toe jam, I'll tell you what. And I was down on the hands and knees scraping this mold off this blanket, and there was little green spores puffing in the sunlight. And I was like, oh. I just got kicked out of treatment. I mean, look what, you really sunk to the bottom this time. And as I was, I'm recalling my experience on the blanket, the World Eskimo Olympics, I always knew that the blankets were round. This one was like 16 feet long, 8 feet wide. And I figured, well, if my geometry is right, I could cut 2 feet off this end, 2 feet off that end, reposition them on the sides, and hey, 12 by 12. Kind of like that treatment center jargon they were telling me about. Anyway. I cut those pieces off, and lo and behold, I had 3 pieces rolled up high, and I went, oh my God, what did I do? It's all their fault. They should have never asked me. I don't even know what I'm doing. And I went, oh yeah, call your elders if you want some help. So I called Paul, told him what I was doing. Now, Paul Tiolanda at the time was alive, and he had survived World War II, and he lost his leg, and he had a wooden leg. I told him what I was doing. He said, okay, I'll come down and look. When he came down, he pushed his glasses up and leaned on his cane, and he said, they ain't done one up. What you gonna tell the board of directors now you ruined their good skin? You ever see elders smiling at you through their eyes and not moving their lips? He was looking at me this way. Recognizing that, I said, Paul, there must be something I can do. Okay, done one up. We'll see if you graduate to be real Eskimo. You soak those skins you cut in a river or lake overnight, and you go to Black Elk's Leather and pick up those six foot, quarter inch black leather strips. You soak those in a bucket of water overnight, too. Tomorrow, you bring those skins together, you get a quarter inch drill, you drill the holes, tie tack them together, and just follow the outline. When you're done, you call me, we'll see if you graduate. Sure enough, the next day, this walrus skin that was so rigid, so tough, was flat pliable, just laid on the ground. It was heavy. You know, I followed his instruction. I was halfway done. Sewed one side up. I was almost done with the other side, and I took a break. You know, during that time, there was a mass media campaign. Anchorage Times was still around. Anchorage Daily News, the newspapers, and the radio stations were all having this campaign to identify a girl dropped off at Providence Hospital. Two guys in a Pinto dropped her off with no identification. They said, "We don't know who she is, and apparently she suffered from an overdose of some kind. She could be Asian, Mexican-American, Alaska Native, don't know who she is. We need to help the general public." And I thought to myself, you know, I just got kicked out of treatment, and it's too bad some people will just go to any lengths, hurt themselves and each other. They don't care, just as long as they get high. And here I am making this blanket. I'm lucky. So I'm almost done with this walrus skin blanket. It took me 50 hours to make, and I took another break. The next day, mass media campaign, big bold letters, Jane Doe identified. And I got my cup of coffee, and they went, "I wonder who that person was, poor soul." Come to find out, this poor soul passed away before they were identified. And as I was reading, I went, "Wait a second. No, that can't be true. That's my best friend's younger sister. She played on the same playground as mine. She's in the Bath from Kotzebue. Her last name was Black." I choked down the rock in my throat. I walked downstairs in disbelief. And I just said, "Why did you let this happen? Why? I'd be supposed to reading about this in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. Not here in Anchorage, not to somebody I know." I tried to hide the tears that were dropping on the blanket. I was in an alleyway, and there was this shirt company making all these shirt prints. And I broke a strand, and the funeral was that afternoon. And all I could do and think about was make a keychain out of that broken strand. And as I thought, what could I do? I could dedicate the stitches in her name. And I told that to the parents, the late Samuel and Pearl Black. They passed away. That blanket traveled with me to over 35 communities. It brought people together, let them joy, just like she did when she was alive. That blanket became a memorial blanket, and I said, "I'm not worthy of this message. You can't ask me to do this." Needless to say, I started to reflect on Black Elk, who was an Indian prophet who had a vision of a hoop within a hoop of many hoops, and that it would signify a time of great healing. And my mind went back to the blanket toss. I went, "What is that but a hoop of people pulling on a bunch of hoops, creating an environment of support where our children don't fall through the cracks in our community and get lost in alcohol and drug abuse?" I also reflected when I first got to that blanket, it was rolled up tight full of mold and mildew, like me. Called a klooch and a salmon cruncher, and I drank and I used and I had all those feelings. But I opened my eyes, opened my life to the wisdom of my culture. That treatment center was wrong. My culture can help me stay sober. We have to pull together, and together we could reach new heights.
That was Gregory Nothstein at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our last storyteller for this show is Bill Bittner, who grew up in Alaska during the 1950s and 60s. Here's a look at his teenage days in Anchorage. Plenty of mischief and hoping for the best.
I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. I went to Chugach Elementary School, Central Junior High School, and West High School. Our rivals were East High School. And back in those days, when you reached the age of 16, that minute, that second, you got your license and you started hanging out with your friends. And one of the things we liked to do was go skiing. And also in those days, the only ski area we had was Arctic Valley. And that was a great place to ski. But the trouble with Arctic Valley is, at the bottom of the road, you had to get out, take the chains out of the trunk, put the chains on back wheels, and drive up. And when you got up to Arctic Valley, they had this long tow rope, and you had this belt on with a carabiner and a hook. You had to hook it on, lean back, and ride up to the top, ski down, and do the whole thing over again. But then, like a miracle, in 1962, I would believe, Alyeska Ski Resort opened, and it was fantastic. You could drive down to Alyeska on the old road. You didn't have to put chains on, and they had this magical stuff called chairlifts that took you up to the top of the mountain, and you could ski up and down. And late one March, some friends of mine and I went down to Alyeska to go skiing. I was with Jack Sedwick and a few other friends, and we had a great day of skiing. And on the way back, we exited Alyeska. We're about 2 miles north of the turnoff to Alyeska. We saw a bunch of our friends, who one of them had a 57 Chevy and had a flat tire, and he was on the side of the road. So, like good teenagers, we pulled over, got out of the car, started talking to him. And all of a sudden, one of them started yelling, "Stop bouncing my car, stop bouncing my car." And this 57 Chevy was bouncing all over the highway. And that was the start of the great 1964 earthquake for us. We had no idea what the heck was going on. And you don't think of a road or the ground as being elastic, but the road was just rolling in waves. And this went on and on and on. It lasted, for 4.5 minutes. And I think at 9.2 on the Richter scale later, it was recorded as the second largest earthquake in North and South America, or perhaps ever. But the first thought was, oh my God, this is the middle of the Cold War, that the Russians had finally dropped an H-bomb on Anchorage, and we're looking around for this hydrogen cloud. We didn't see that. And then as the earthquake went on and on and on, you could hardly stand up. We thought, oh my God, is this the end of the world or what? Trees are whipping around, the road's cracking, rocks are falling. Finally, it all came to an end. And so, being good teenagers, we kind of looked at each other and said, what do we do now? Everybody except Jack Sedwick and I said, well, let's go back to Alyeska and party. And Jack and I, being the bright guys we were, said, no, we're going to walk back to Anchorage without giving it much thought. The earthquake was like at 5:24 p.m. or something like that. So we started walking back to Anchorage, you know, two teenagers. We come around the corner where Bird Flats are, and here's six big avalanches that had come down off the mountain, crossed the tracks, taken the railroad tracks and just turned it into spaghetti and taken it right out into the inlet. So we're walking up over these avalanches, and there's a car in between, and this guy is down on the ground going, oh, thank you, Lord. And these aftershocks kept shaking, and I said to Jack, I said, you know, God, we could die here if another avalanche comes. And Jack says, Bill, think about it. Look up there. He said, the snow's all gone. Went, yeah, okay, that's good. So we kept walking. We got around the curve, and here comes a car. It must have been going 80 miles an hour, just roaring by. We said, well, that's a good sign. So we stop and try to wave them down, and the car just shoots by us. And so in a few minutes later, he comes putting back because he was blocked by the avalanches. And it turns out it was this old guy from Kenai. He was trying to get back to Kenai. So he rolls down his window and said, we need to go back to Anchorage. And he said, kids, there's no more Anchorage. It's destroyed. And this is the first time we thought, oh my God, because I was anxious to get back to tell my folks what a great adventure we just had, not really thinking about it. And this old guy had been sitting on the bar at D&D bar on the bar stool. And that's at 4th and C Street, and that's where the street dropped a half a block. This guy is thrown down, the bar falls on top of him. He gets out, climbs up the hill, looks around, everything looks like devastation, jumps in his car, and takes off. So, Jesus, we're in trouble now. Now we better get back to see if anybody is alive. So we finally get to Indian, find a convoy of cars, and they inch their way back to Anchorage. We get back to Turnagain, where Jack lives, and the police are going through the neighborhood saying, a tsunami is coming, a tsunami is coming, evacuate. And Jack's dad, who's a pretty smart guy, said, we're not going anywhere. He said, we're 80 miles from the start of the ocean. it'll be 8 inches by the time we get here. So I wander home and I'm thinking, I walked by West High School and it was all a wreck, and I thought, great, I'm gonna party for a week or 10 days with my friends. It's not too bad, you know. No sewage, no water, but who cares when you're a teenager? And so the next morning I'm trying to sleep in and my mother comes in my room and roused me out and said, I just heard on the radio the railroad wants any able-bodied worker to come down and sign up. I said, I don't know, Mom, that's some hard work. He said, get down to the railroad and sign up. So I said, okay. So they assigned me to a section gang starting at Potter Marsh, and we went south from there, and it was the hardest work I've ever done in my life. And I remember about a week later, I'm leaning on the iron bar we used to straighten the track and looking out over the old railroad ties that had been all wrecked, you know, and I had two thoughts, and one of them was, God, I hope school starts again. And I'm so tired. And the second thought I had is, fingers crossed, I hope we don't have a big earthquake like this for another at least 53 years. Thank you.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA, and that was Bill Bittner at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts. Well, that's all we have for this show. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you too could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard, the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This show was edited at the Alaska Teen Media Institute by Kendall Stormo. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips, what I give me some. We fuss and fight when things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries. Going out.